welcome Deborah Rabian back to the store for the release of her new book, The Famous Flower of Serving Men, which is the second in the Murder, Music, and Ghosts of the Past series. In her latest, the charming Penny and Ringan return as they work to renovate a beautiful London theater that Penny has inherited from a distant French aunt, and they once again find themselves in closer contact with the long-gone world than they would like. Ladies and gentlemen, please join me in giving a very warm welcome to Ms. Deborah Rabian.
Automatically reaching for the mic that I don't ever use anyway.
Hi guys.
Take the glasses off to talk. Want to say thanks to everybody for coming out. It's a little bit better weather than we had the last time around. I brought a blizzard with me last time I came. And we still managed to get, you know, quite a decent crowd in. We had a fire going, and Laura was incredibly hospitable. And as last time, we now have cookies. Anybody here who is not familiar with the series? One person. Good, you give me an excuse to talk. We always love that.
Excellent.
Am I audible? Am I, because we're going to be reading in pretty much this volume. Everybody here fine?
Mm-hmm.
Great. Basically speaking, in the first book, we meet the characters, the human characters that we're going to be seeing down the line through the series. Rupert Lane, nicknamed Ringan, which is a good old Scots nickname, who is a folk musician, lives in the UK, and discovers early on in his career that playing traditional music for a living, not so much unless you're, you know, a superstar, which you don't become right away. Like most other musicians in the UK, he's got a university background in something else, which helps you pay the rent. His case happens to be period property restoration, and he consults with the National, you know, the National Trust and various, you know, on call for property owners who want to bring their property back to the way it was. In the first book, he is stiffed for a fee, not out of malice, but the gentleman in Glastonbury whose manor he's restored has gotten himself into a bit of a cash crunch. And he's offered a cottage instead, just a life leasehold on this cottage on Scott's estate near Glastonbury, and not being an idiot, he says, free rent, own cottage, plus a little tithe barn on the property. Yeah, takes it, discovers that not only the cottage, but the barn are both haunted within a day of being there. And he and his girlfriend, who does not live with him, these are two people in their late 30s, his girlfriend Penny is a theatrical producer. She has her own troupe. She specializes in certain period drama, and she travels a lot. They don't, you know, live in the same house. She lives in London. She comes down and discovers that she's fairly sensitive to this stuff and doesn't much like it. He likes it even less than she does. And they basically need to find out who these people were and how the hell to get rid of them so he can have his house back, which they do. The second book is The Famous Flower of Serving Men, which is basically Penny's story. She, is a theatrical producer, and to lead you into this one, she inherits a piece of property from a very eccentric French aunt who, this will please Jilly, I think, who has just died on her 90th birthday, celebrating her 90th birthday in a golf club in Edinburgh with some of the local talent, and fell down a flight of stairs and broke her neck. She was just quite an amazing and wonderful old lady, and she left her niece by marriage a theater in EC4, which is an older section of London. It's not West End, it's not prime theater territory, but it has a lot of Victorian playhouses and a lot of restored smaller. You couldn't have done the big dramas there, for instance, in the 19th century. There were licensing laws in London that prohibited theaters that weren't actually, you know, licensed by the Crown from doing things like Shakespeare, but they would have had comedy and vaudeville. And she has left Penny this theater and enough money to restore it and a very enigmatic letter. And we're going to read. I also want to introduce Juliana Egli, from who a lot of you know, who came in from Minneapolis. And I'm going to read two parts of a prologue, which happens 25 years before Penny inherits the theater and 600 years after the events that lead to what is now happening in the theater. Just to give you a sense of what is going on there and what they're about to deal with. And I will then read a, that's very short, it's just the prologue, and then I'm just going to read a short chapter section in which Penny and the senior actor in her troupe, David Harkin, have a little encounter of their own in the theater, which is called The Belfield, and that's B-E-L-L-E-F-I-E-L-D, and it's important as the book goes on. Juliana is going to be the voice of our ghost, so we will get to that momentarily, but who will start out with the prologue. And everybody can hear just fine. Am I going too fast for anyone? Good. All right. On a raw January night in 1979, a homeless man and a small dog wandered into a nameless alley off Bouverie Street in the city and prepared to set up sleeping quarters. It was brutally cold. Europe was seeing one of its worst winter seasons in half a century, and Londoners were currently miserable, dealing with iced-over streets and an incessant windy downpour of sleet that needled the skin and made safe walking an impossibility. Few people willingly came outdoors in this weather, but the homeless man, a beggar of many years' standing, had no choice in the matter. He surveyed his chosen refuge with a practiced eye. The north side of the alley offered the most shelter. There were two doors in the long wall of whatever this building was, one that looked like a loading dock with old-fashioned pocket doors, and one just a normal door a few feet away. The loading dock had a bit of an overhang, cutting back on the wind and the sleet. The dog sat at his feet, patient and obedient, shivering. The homeless man piled his bits of cardboard and tattered cloth atop a sheet of plastic he'd found behind a warehouse near London Bridge. The plastic would keep the damp out. He curled up, whistled for the dog, made room for the little terrier to curl up beside him, and pulled an old battered sleeping bag around them both. The dog, grateful but used to this ritual, snuggled close. Bloody Margaret Thatcher. The man spoke aloud, also a nightly ritual. His eyes were almost shut. The dog listened, or perhaps not. Things get worse when you put the Tories in. We could rot here. You think they'd care? Not bloody likely. This time the dog answered him. The man opened one eye. What in hell? Against his side, warm under the pile, the dog had gone rigid. His master had a sudden clear vision of the animal, legs planted, short coat bristling, teeth bared, glaring at something twisted and ugly and wrong. Someone was whispering. The man lay very still, listening himself, both eyes wide and staring at a faded, filthy pattern of red and black plaid that was the lining of his sleeping bag. Someone was there. Someone had come. Someone was whispering. Why couldn't he understand a word of it? And why was he afraid to look outside the safety of his blanket? The dog began to whine. It was loud, much too loud, muffled by the warmth of the man and the pile of cloth and the stifling reek of a sudden, inexplicable fear that the man could neither articulate nor control. He lay listening to a dark alien rasp that sounded like the hissing of an adder. He'd never been so frightened in his life. The whines became a howl. There was a scrabbling, a kick, and then the terrier bolted, exploding out into the alley, howling and barking as it went. Oi, come back here! The man was on his feet, his fear of whatever was whispering unseen in the darkness, momentarily swallowed by the greater terror of losing his only companion. He peered into the sleety night. Something was wrong with his eyes. There were street lamps out on Bouverie Place, but he could see nothing but odd shapes. Was that mist blocking his vision? Winter mist come up from the River Thames? He smelled it suddenly. Smoke, a pungent reek of burning that was tainted with something darker. In his mind, as clear as his mental picture of the dog growling and bristling, he saw people in wooden houses, the houses burning, the people trapped and screaming, no way out, no way down, and only death waiting. He began to cough, to choke, his eyes watering. Someone whispered, counterpointing the screams of those trapped. Out in Bouverie Street, the dog whimpered. With shaking, uncoordinated hands, the homeless man retrieved his belongings. It was hard to move. His feet felt leaden and slow, and he'd never been so afraid. But all he possessed was there. Without this pile, he'd be half frozen to death before the break of day. He couldn't simply abandon it. He dragged the pile clear of the alley, listening to the noises become part of the shadows and fade out behind him. The dog ran to him and sat, pressing up against his legs. They moved away, the man muttering under his breath. He wasn't aware of his own speech, and would have been very surprised indeed had he realized he was praying. So that gives you the setting, just what it is that Penny and her guys are about to deal with. Give me a mouthful of that. And I'm going to read you, as I say, just a short chapter section, in which you really get a hint of what they're going to have to deal with. Penny has taken clear probate, taken possession of the theater, which is called the Belfield, and it's just, for those who know London, it's just, 5 minutes walk up from Fleet Street, heading south toward the River Thames. And she's already become aware that there's something going on, that there's something weird about it, that it doesn't feel right. She has heard what she thought was a muttering somewhere in the basement, and Ringan, who could not hear it, informs her that the theater has no basement, because if you know London, you know that things right at the edge of the river around the Thames in that part of London, the tube stations, for example, are sunk very deep because it's mostly wet clay, and the Thames has a history of flooding. So people building in the 19th century did not sink deep. You have to go down 60 feet minimum just to get clear of the dam. Basically, they would just build on the surface, lift the floor, and theaters in that part of London have literally just enough room for mechanisms and somebody to crawl underneath. So she is aware that something has been going on, and Ringan has had an encounter of his own. But from the moment of walking into the theater, Penny had picked up stray lines of a play, and she finally tracked it down to a play by Euripides, Iphigenia and Aulis, which is about, of course, you know, the story, basically a child, you know, a parent willing to sacrifice, murder their own child for a particular cause. And this is a very odd thing for her to think about. It's not her field of expertise. It's not the period in which she produces. She specializes in Jacobean and Elizabethan drama, and this predates it by 1800 years. But she has become basically obsessed with opening the theater, doing Iphigenia, and they've decided to sort of, you know, go on with rehearsal. And we have here Penny, as work is beginning. Ringan has hired people. Work going on, beginning to go on in the theater. There are workmen in the theater. And Penny is sitting there, and David Harkin, who is the senior male actor in her acting troupe, the Tamburlaine Players, has come in and wants to have a conversation. Penny, can you spare me a moment? Penny, seated in the first row of the Belfields pit, glanced up with unfocused eyes. A tattered paperback of Iphigenia lay open in her lap. Oh, David. Sorry, I was going over Clytemnestra's little How Dare You Lie to Me speech to Agamemnon. Listen to this line. We buy what we loathe with what we love. Gorgeous, isn't it? Very. It's a juicy play, all told. David Harkin sat down just behind her. But I did want to ask you about it. Penny had known this since the meeting at the Beldame that this was probably coming, and she was still not really prepared to answer. She closed the book and met his gaze. I was waiting for someone to hit me with it. Ask me as in why I was so adamant about wanting to do it? That's it. He cleared his throat. You know, I wouldn't have brought this up when you first announced it. After all, you were trying to nail down a partnership with Albert Wixell, and none of us would have dreamed of arguing or questioning your decision under those circumstances. A solid attempt at securing financing is no time to have your authority or your creative decisions challenged, and we certainly wouldn't have wanted to sabotage the chance. Besides, it's a marvelous piece, and we're quite excited over it, but... His voice trailed away. But it's off my usual lists, and I seemed awfully set on doing it. Is that it? Penny modulated her voice upwards. There was banging coming from backstage. Plumbers Ringan had hired were installing new pipes and back-to-back sink units in the two-star dressing rooms. It was the first day of many in which the Belfield would ring with workmen hammering, sawing, yelling from room to room. Since Penny had decided to begin rehearsals at once, the next few weeks were likely to be chaotic, even without taking a possible haunting into consideration. That's it, David agreed. It's not just me, and please don't think we're objecting. We're not idiots. We love the play and the idea in general, and Petra in particular is over the moon about the part. But you seemed, well, almost fierce. And leaving aside that you're not usually fierce, I got the impression there was something else going on. Donald noticed it too, and he's feeling a bit uneasy. Penny, be straight with me. Is there something odd about this place? Ah, damn. Penny closed her eyes for a moment. Over the distant banging, was that something else she was hearing? Someone whispering? No, surely not. Wasn't possible, not with the noise those workmen were producing. Penny, sorry, I was distracted there for a moment. She wondered how much to tell him. None of the cast members knew anything about the haunting of Ringan's new home the previous summer. Something in Penny had closed down at the thought of treating something so powerful as backstage chatter, mere gossip or dinner table conversation. Betsy Roper, before her passage into whatever unimaginable corner of eternity had finally claimed her, had left a bit of herself with Penny, and Penny would not disrespect that memory or take its results lightly. No. Penny, listen. David's head was canted sharply to one side. Is there some... Jesus, what on earth is that? Penny sucked in her breath. No, she thought, no. Don't be this. Don't do this. I'm not ready to deal with this. Whispering, harsh and guttural, rose from the floor, the seats, the ground beneath them. It gained resonance, lifting to a nearly metallic pitch of desperation. Filled the auditorium like a flood tide of dirty seawater.
Arrêtez, mauvais, mauvais. Je fonce Dieu, que vous avez offense Dieu. Arrêtez, libérez-moi, trop chaud, le feu de la peur. Trop chaud, me blesse, me brûle. Arrête!
The room filled with smoke. They could smell it, taste it on the still air. Invisible, it forced itself into lungs, eyes, nostrils. This time the smell of water was entirely absent. Here was wood and thatch, catching, feeding, jumping from joist to beam to eaves, taking and spreading. It was laced with ugliness, an unearthly barbecue neither meant nor fit for the human senses. Penny gagged, coughing, fanning at nothing and fighting for air. David Harkins, his jacket pulled up to protect his airways, was the color of dirty ice. He looked blind. "We have to get out." Penny, not knowing if her voice had sounded beyond her own bone-dry throat, got David by the sleeve of his jacket. Unheeded, the paperback Euripides fell from her lap to the carpet. "Hurry, go, come on, David, move."
"Vite, je vous en prie, enlevez-moi les despotistes de crochage, s'il vous plaît."
He came up limply, letting Penny drag him. As she pulled him up the aisle toward the foyer door, stumbling and panting in whimpering breath, she felt how physically unresponsive he seemed, heard his shallow gasps for air, and wondered if he was having a heart attack.
"Un prêtre, je vous en prêtre, s'il vous plaît, ne me laisse pas brûler."
The words pulsing with tangible agony crested and died as Penny kicked the foyer door open and wrenched David clear of the auditorium. Something, an audible memory, or perhaps nothing more than an echo of those cries for pity and surcease, streamed out in a rush through the propped open front doors and into the chilly London afternoon, only to dissipate like burned out fireflies as they met the reality of the modern world. And that's all I'm reading, and thank you, Juliana, for making it absolutely awesome. Thank you for not making me break and read the French. It can do it, but you just go, it's like, oh, this is, I'm going to miss you when you're not here with me this morning. Signing. So there we go. Does anybody have any questions about the series or about the book in particular, granted that most of you have read it? Silence?
I'm actually one of the people who hasn't read it, and could you talk a little bit about, I know the titles come from old ballads, but could you talk a little bit about this title in particular?
Ah, yes, this is an old, as far as anybody can tell, this one is an old border ballad from the north, actually from the north country of, literally between Scotland, basically the River Clyde coming down to like the north of England to where the Percys used to be in charge, you know, Yorkshire in the north. There are a couple of different versions of it. It's in the, I think, the second volume of the Collected Child Ballads. It's the words that I use, and you'll find them as chapter headings throughout the book. The song itself has, about 40 verses. It has ghosts, it has magical animals and leading, and basically speaking, it's told by a young woman called Eleanor, who basically, the first verse says it all. "My mother did me deadly spite, for she sent thieves in the dark of the night, put my servants all to flight, they robbed my bower, they slew my knight." And basically, she's a young girl, and according to her version of the story, her mother was a complete fruit loop, sent a hired assassin after her because she didn't want to join a nunnery or something, and ran off to get married instead. And the would-be assassins ended up killing not her, but her husband and her newborn son, left her the sword to kill herself with, and she decided, "I don't think so." And instead, she went into drag, cut off her hair, dressed up as a guy, changed her name to William, and went off to, as she says, serve her king as the famous flower of serving men. And the definitive version of this is done by the best musician doing this stuff alive, Martin McCarthy. And we had a conference over this, and I said, "Okay, from the feel of the song, I want to set the events in the middle of the Peasants' Rebellion, because it's right in my wheelhouse, and I used to tutor this stuff, and I don't have to do a lot of research, and it just feels like it's from that period. Is there any reason at all it couldn't be, you know, sort of mid to late Plantagenet period?" He said, "No reason at all, assuming it wasn't some little border, could have been some little, you know, border guy called Walter the Moneyless trotting around in his bog and, you know, calling himself a king. You can make it anybody you want to, you know, anywhere in about a 400-year period and get away with it." So I decided to set it there. The song itself, one of the things that runs through this, through the entire series, is the concept that a song, whether, you know, specifically the bardic songs that tell you a story, that literally have a plot, you know, you're only ever seeing one person's point of view. What happens if it's not true? What happens if the person telling the story is covering up or remembering wrong or what, you know? So in this one, which starts out with a crime, which starts out with a murder, I started wondering what happens if maybe Eleanor's not telling the truth. Maybe that's not the whole story. Maybe there was something else going on, you know. Maybe there were no villains in this. Maybe there were no innocents in this, you know, just what exactly happened. And then, of course, had to create a crime, and that turned into a crime within a crime, and a fairly explosive version of an exorcism. There's nothing gentle about this ghost or how she died, and there's nothing gentle about the song. I mean, it's very little bits of lore if you want them from the song. You'll hear a use of the phrase "hokey ground," which is the old English countryside, Southern England actually, countryside term for hawthorn, the plant hawthorn, which, as it happens, was used as an accelerant when people were being burned at the stake because it burns so nicely. And her theater is located on Hawthorn Walk, so there are lots of, you know, little touches like that.
What's the next book? And
Maddie Groves.
When's it coming out?
Next autumn, and it's on my editor's desk, and the ghost in that one is a real... he's an incubus.
That works.
He's really nasty. Yeah, he's extremely nasty.
A lot of fun to write.
So, I see. Are you and Julie heading off to go to a different thing?
Don't know.
Are we done, or any more questions? Anybody, can I do anything? Answer anything for anybody? Julie Allen? I think we're done. Everybody's read the series, so it's like, hey.
That's not true. Not all of us have read both.
I haven't.
Yeah, well, you could.
I've just had too many other good books.
Oh, yeah, now that's flattering, dude.
He's getting there.
Oh, it's
he's just
fine.
Got into reading in the last year, so
it's fine. It's fine. I remember discovering Shirley Jackson and refusing to read anybody else for about the next 3 years, which is basically, uh-huh. What else did she write? There's got to be more. Yeah. No, it's good. Find your cover.
You're reading.
We are reading. Yeah, once you find books, it's a good thing to find.
Yep.
Are we done? We finished? Great. There's cookies. Laura set out cookies at the back. Everybody gets dessert.
Yay.